This week on the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we discuss the latest news, customer service, review the requirements for your medical record department, including chart audits and reviews, and discuss provider peer review. Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a weekly podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This week's episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading full-service ASC regulatory compliance consulting firms, and the Regulatory Compliance series of books for ASCs by John Gailey and published by Eden Group Development.
Welcome to episode 22 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for May 28th, 2018, recording from our studios in Rochester, New York. This is Jenna Alvarez, Senior Nurse Consultant with Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, and I'm here with Sue Cronkite, also a Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and John Gailey, the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and Eden Group Development, and one of the nation's leading ASC industry experts in regulatory compliance, finance, and administration. John is the author of over 10 books about the ASC industry and a frequent national speaker on all aspects of ambulatory surgery center management. Welcome, everyone.
Hello, Jenna. Hello. It's great to be have you back on the show. You were gone for the last episode as you were...
enjoying my vacation.
That's right. And then for those of you that don't know, Sue and I joined her later on. We probably should mention that Jen is my daughter and Susan is my significant other. So this is kind of a family here. So this isn't some weird thing that happens because we do a podcast, right? So we had a lot of fun in Tahoe. Our dream of actually recording this episode while we were in Tahoe did not occur.
Your dream.
More of a nightmare, I guess. And we had to travel with all of this equipment to do that, and we never really used it. Oh, well.
It was beautiful, though. We got a lot of sightseeing.
And if you haven't seen, there was a picture posted in LinkedIn of the three of us enjoying a mountain scenery. And so definitely see the three of us having fun. So we've had a lot of developments this week, even though we were on vacation with the podcast. So I just want to kind of update everybody on a few things. First of all, we do have a new sponsor joining us for an upcoming episode, Priority One. Nelson Gomes will be joining us in about 2 weeks for some discussions on information technology in an ambulatory surgery center, electronic medical records, and cybersecurity, which is, of course, a very, very hot topic right now. And then the other thing that's been happening, as we all know, this originally started as a 30-minute podcast, and a lot of our episodes have been inching up closer to an hour. I mean, one of them actually was 50 minutes. And once we reach an hour, we can actually give AEU credits because Eden Group Development, which is the producer of the show, does have a an agreement with BASC, the organization that provides the CAS credential, to do AEU credits. So what we've decided to do is on some of our longer episodes, we're actually going to get them past an hour, and we're going to give away or give AEU credits for that. So the first extended podcast will be next week, June 4th. And we have applied and actually got notification a couple days ago that we're able to offer one AEU credit for this special one-hour podcast. And the topic next week is going to be pharmaceutical services, opioid use, and how to decrease it, and an anesthesiologist's perspective on appropriate candidates for surgery. I know it's an awful, it's a mouthful there, but it's a great episode. We've already recorded quite a bit of it. It is free to listen to, but if you want to get one AEU credit in the clinical area or provision of patient care, you'll be given a link on our website, and for $35, you get one AEU. The producer of the AC podcast with John Gailey is an approved AEU provider through the Board of Ambulatory Surgery Certification, which oversees the CASC and CAPE credentials. Then we'll have another extended podcast on July 2nd, a month later, again, 1 hour, and the podcast will be on educational programs. And we're actually going to be recording it during the Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies annual retreat in the Poconos. Mm-hmm. Now, I know it starts to sound like we spend an awful lot of time out of town and I guess in mountains here, but AHS is heading down to the Poconos for our about a 3-4 day annual retreat. And during it, we're going to report a special podcast on education, including orientation, annual mandatory training, and in-services. And we're going to have a lot of great tools available on the website for our listeners. And again, that will be one AEU of credit for human resources. And again, free to listen and $35 for that AEU credit.
A lot of people have a hard time getting human resources credits, so that's going to be especially beneficial.
Absolutely. That's one of the complaints that we've had with the CAS credential is that we have a hard time getting human resources credits. So I thought maybe that's one way we can help benefit the CAS community by giving some of those with our podcasts.
Yeah.
So, Sue, what's up with the news?
All right. Well, I wanted to share some information I found at MNET Health News, MNETNEWS.com. Their May 21st issue has an article on the top three reasons why some ASCs fail. The article noted that almost 50% of new ASCs opened since 2009 have closed. The three reasons identified were, number one was failure to attract cases with high reimbursements, failure to prioritize patient care, and poorly managed contracts. They suggested focusing not only on high volume of cases, but also high reimbursement procedures, although I know that could mean having to expand your specialty areas. The patient care area is just to emphasize good medical care, obviously, as in preventing infection, but also leaving patients feeling cared for and resolving any issues that may come up so they have a lot of good things to say about your center when they're talking to their friends and other people. John, you are pretty passionate about customer service and care and leaving people with a good impression and really making people enjoy their experience.
You know, it's interesting. I'm coming back from Lake Tahoe yesterday. You and I, Sue and I, were at the airport, and it's just interesting how little things kind of get to you. And you were checking in with your big bag.
Yes.
And they put it on the scale, and it came out to be, what is it,
59 pounds.
59 pounds, which I guess, as far as the American Airlines person was concerned, was practically a crime. So, you know, it's all, she really wasn't mean or anything like that. It's just that it was a bad first impression. And this is after we had already paid, what was it, $74 to get extra knee room, $70 to have three bags, because we had three bags we checked. And then they come back and say it's going to be another $100 for...
For an extra 9 pounds.
For an extra 9 pounds.
$100 for 9 pounds.
And it bothered you. I mean, I remember we got onto the plane, we're flying in, and Sue is still upset about this thing. And as I thought about it afterwards, this is just another case of how, you know, this is totally uncontrolled by American Airlines. You know, this one person. And by the way, you know, she probably had good training. She probably had the best of intentions. But in the end, it's just the way she said things to us, the way she brought it out. She said, you know, you could save a lot of money by, you know, putting the extra 10 pounds in another suitcase. I don't know where she thought we were going to come up with an empty suitcase, you know, there in line. But it left us with a bad impression. And the point that I would make here is that receptionist that you have, those first impressions, the person that calls the patient the day before surgery, the person that calls about the financial, you know, arrangements that need to be made, all of those people have patient contact. And often they are not the highest paid individuals. Well, they're certainly not the highest paid individuals in our organization. And sometimes they're very hard to find these people. And I think we just have to be very careful about those first impressions and how we treat our patients. And it's no surprise to me when I when I hear that one of the failures is because of the way we treat our patients. But it's not only the nurses, it's not only the doctors, it's also all that back office staff.
I remember being really impressed by one of the newer centers that I visited recently with you. And a patient had come in and she was confused about where to go in and just some things that really weren't the center's fault. But she was really very irritable. She was seemed like somebody that could be hard to deal with usually, but the receptionist was wonderful with her and, you know, really apologized. It wasn't the center's fault, as I said, but she apologized. She even commented on her, you know, she had a beautiful purse or something, you know, just kind of really trying to turn it around and be welcoming. And, you know, I was very impressed that she did that, even not needing to and not, but taking that responsibility and making the woman feel like she was heard and that she was going to do what she could to make her experience better.
Well, and another interesting point about that is, while we did all the training for that particular staff, we didn't train her on that specifically.
Yeah, it just was a skill she
It was a skill she,
really
she had.
So the third thing, I'm going to ask John if you could talk about that, the contracts.
Sure. So another failure point is because of organizations that, fail to have good reimbursement contracts. And that's not an area that we spend a lot of time talking about on this podcast. Matter of fact, I don't think we've talked about it at all yet. But it's another good example of how you either have to hire individuals in your organization or consider outsourcing it. You know, one of the themes that we've had within ambulatory healthcare strategies is that it is really impossible nowadays to find an administrator that has all the skills that are necessary in order to be able to do all of those things that are important in the organization to make it successful. And, you know, from a reimbursement standpoint, clinical care, from the legal, from the financial, from contracting, all of those are very complicated areas, and trying to find somebody with all those skills is very difficult. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for those new organizations out there, and even the older organizations, you just have to strategically place yourself in a position where you have, you know, you outsource those things that you don't do well, and make sure that you do a great job, or you have good employees that do a great job on those things that you have the skill set for. That's the whole scope of our company, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, is who wants to do regulatory compliance. Mm-hmm. Other than us, you know, we enjoy it. So people outsource that to us. Same thing with contracting. You know, there are people out there that you can hire to do contracting, or perhaps you've indeed hired somebody in your own organization that's good at it, but they're not going to be able to do all of those things at the same time. And that's where you have to kind of figure, I'm going to outsource those things that are not necessarily my strengths. So let's take a short break, and we'll come back and talk about medical records and chart audits. And for our last segment, we're going to talk about peer review. So stay tuned.
So this week, we are focusing on medical record oversight and peer review. Let's start with medical record oversight. John, can you talk about the CMS conditions for coverage?
Sure. So medical records falls under 416.47 in the regulations, which states the ASC must maintain complete, comprehensive, and accurate medical records to ensure adequate patient care, that the ASC must develop and maintain a system for proper collection, storage, and use of patient records, and that the ASC must maintain a medical record for each patient. And very important here is that record must be distinct from the physician record for those small organizations that might have considered combining them. Every record must be accurate, legible, and promptly completed, and medical records must include at least the following: patient identification, significant medical history and results of a physical examination, that's that H&P, preoperative diagnostic studies entered before surgery if performed, findings and techniques of the operation, in other words, the operative report, the pathology report on any tissues that are removed during surgery except those that have been exempted by the governing body, any allergies and abnormal drug reactions, and emphasis there on the reaction, entries related to anesthesia administration, documentation of a properly executed informed consent, and a discharge diagnosis. Jenna, do you want to talk a little bit about HHC and Joint Commission?
Yeah, so Joint Commission and HHC both also specify the specific elements of compliance that need to be inside the medical record, and a lot of those go along the same lines as the
CMS
regulations. The Joint Commission, interestingly, specifically discusses requiring the audits of its clinical records. And
you mean like chart reviews?
Chart reviews.
Okay.
And states that the organization reviews its clinical records to confirm that the required information is present, accurate, legible, authenticated, and completed on time. HHC doesn't specifically state that in their medical records section, but they do talk in Chapter 5 with the quality improvement that these centers must audit critical processes.
So there's a system in place in order to make sure that medical records are complete and accurate.
HHC requires a system for accurate collection, processing, maintenance, and storage. Retrieval and distribution of clinical records is maintained. And then they specifically require that a designated person is in charge of the medical records. And in the new requirements, it's a little bit more specified if the center has a health information system, that there also must be a designated person in charge of the health information system, and that the system needs to ensure that it adheres to the written policies and procedures of the center, and someone needs to be monitoring that system on a regular basis for compliance.
So I know there's a lot of emphasis on electronic medical records right now, but I know most of the centers still have paper. There are beginning to be some electronic medical records available. It's a significant change. And I think even though they say they'll save time, cut staffing, reducing legal risk, I think it's just something you have to carefully consider and be sure you're ready for it. And I know, like we mentioned in an earlier podcast, the lawyers that were speaking at the New York State meeting pointed out that they would rather defend paper records than electronic records.
Which is just blows my mind, because there's mm-hmm. so much emphasis right now on EMR and how great EMR is for improving patient care and improving operations. But to hear lawyers tell us mm-hmm. that they would much rather, they're unanimous in this, much rather defend a paper record was kind of an important element. I think what we're saying is that these EMR systems that have been designed for ambulatory surgery centers are just not to the point yet where they can really be fully beneficial, at least all those promises that people have made to it. Regardless of the system that you use, though, you do need to make sure that your organization has the following. You have to have a designated person in charge of the medical record. And by the way, that's one of the issues that I find during surveys sometimes is that everybody seems to know, oh, like Susie over in the medical records department is the person that takes care of it. But, you know, the person in charge is the person that takes responsibility for the policies and procedures, the person that oversees that department. They're responsible for making sure that chart audits are done on a regular basis. So be very careful about who you choose to be in charge of medical records, because that's the person that really should be interviewed during a CMS, AAHC, or Joint Commission survey to be able to answer all these questions. So that individual is going to be responsible for the security of the system, be it electronic or, you know, paper record, the forms that are in the charts or the forms that have been created in the electronic medical record. And that's no small thing. Jenna, you spend half your life, I think, now lately in modifying forms that go into the medical records for our clients. The format of the charts. In other words, what's the order of all the information that goes in there? Are you going to have tabs to separate out the different areas? The contents themselves, making sure that that content is complete, and overseeing the chart audits, making sure that somebody on a regular basis is reviewing the forms in the charts to make sure everything is complete. Jenna, why don't you talk a little bit about chart audits?
So ideally, you should have a medical records clerk who is going to be reviewing the charts for completeness. And then you're also going to be doing nursing chart audit, peer review on occasion, and then having a medical record consultant.
Is always a good idea, right?
Yeah. Or sometimes it's required by state.
Right. Like in New York, you're required to have a medical record expert available. It doesn't necessarily have to be a consultant. Like if you have an employee that is credentialed or is certified in medical records, that would take the place of an outside consultant. But most ASCs, at least in New York, don't have that. I don't know of any other state that requires a person to have a medical record degree, but it's certainly a good idea. I think the medical record chart audits that we get from our experts are always excellent, always help our organizations be better prepared for a survey.
Well, they just make you think about things that you might not have recognized before because you've been doing things one way for so long.
Right.
And, you know, having an outside person look at your records gives you a different perspective.
Well, and the other interesting thing, too, is that we focus a lot in this podcast with regulatory issues. We branch out a little bit more as we take on the bigger role that we expect of ourselves here. The other issue is, of course, legal, making sure that your medical record doesn't get you in trouble if you're ever sued. So nursing chart audits include a number of elements, and I think it's hard to actually give a list to everybody out there because a medical record chart audit that's usually done by a nurse should be based upon your experience. So if you find that your nurses are not completing or signing certain documents, you should be including that in a chart audit. There are certain things that need to be included in every chart audit, such as H&Ps and, you know, was a proper discharge summary given with the patient, medication reconciliation, things like that. But I think that really you should be very careful about making sure you develop your own medical record chart audit and then modify that as you find problems as you're going through these medical records or you're finding, especially when a surveyor comes in and makes a comment or your medical record consultant makes a comment.
Yeah, I know. We have one center that tracks their nurses are terrible at charting where they're starting the IVs.
Yes.
And month after month, that's always the lowest one, but they keep tracking it and it has been improving.
That's
but,
right.
You know,
so not above 90% yet. But.
If you notice, you know, something specifically that is missing, you know, just add that to your chart audit. And then again, you can do that as your quality improvement, part of your quality improvement process, showing that you've identified a problem and that you're tracking and trending it and,
right.
You know, improving it.
Well, and interestingly, a lot of our plans of correction actually include monitoring of certain elements, which often fall down to the chart audit. So, okay, let's take a short break and we'll continue with our discussion of peer review.
One of the sponsors of the ASC podcast with John Gailey is Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. John, can you tell us about some of the services that AHS offers?
Sure. So we are a regulatory oversight organization. We basically are involved in the business of helping organizations to always be prepared for surveys and to respond to surveys and just to become your outsourced regulatory compliance organization. We also do financial oversight too, but the stuff that's probably most pertinent to most of our listeners relates to regulatory compliance and accreditation compliance. So our goal is always to have our organizations remain prepared for surveys. And so we'll, to that end, we maintain the policy manuals. We develop educational programs. We can even do the educational programs for the organization. We oversee the quality improvement program. We write the minutes for the quality improvement program, if that's what the organization wishes. And we help run the governing body meetings, again, if that's what the organization wants. And we'll write the governing body minutes for that. We also do periodic mock surveys. We help the organization through a survey, and we'll help them respond to the plan of correction necessary after a deemed status survey. And most importantly, this is all at a fixed price that might surprise most of our listeners.
Hey, so how do our listeners learn more?
So for a free, no-obligation consultation, give me a call at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And you can also visit our website at www.ah-strategies.com and fill out the Contact Us form.
Okay, thanks, John.
Before the next segment, I want to point out that it was recorded prior to the New York State Association meeting, and it was our intention to air the segment prior to the meeting. As sometimes happens, we had a change in our plans and decided to air it after the meeting. So I apologize for any confusion about the timing in the discussion. So on to the segment.
So John, you'll be doing a session at the New York State Association conference this week on peer review process. And I know we've talked about that a little bit in the past. We decided to talk a little more in depth about it today.
I thought this would be a good introduction for this coming speech, as well as to give our listeners here who won't have the pleasure of going to Albany, New York, to listen to the New York State Association meeting, an idea of what we're going to be talking about. So peer review, of course, is a very hot topic right now. A lot of issues in surveys with organizations not having proper peer review programs or not doing the proper things to assure that peer review is, you know, carried out in their organization at the correct levels. So let's first of all define what peer review is. So peer review is the process of reviewing the care provided by individual practitioners and the medical staff as a whole to identify opportunities for improvement and to assess the competencies of the practitioners for purposes of determining their eligibility for recredentialing. The results of peer review activities are reported to the QAPI committee, the Quality Assurance and Performance Improvement Committee, and to the board, and are used as appropriate in determining quality improvement activities that should be undertaken. So let's also mention where this shows up in CMS standards. So this actually falls in section 416.43B, which is a standard related to program data. And number one says the program must incorporate quality indicator data, including patient care and other relevant data regarding services furnished in the ASC. And two says the ASC must use the data collected to, number one, monitor the effectiveness and safety of its services and quality of its care. Number two, and this is the most important one, identify opportunities that could lead to improvements and changes in its patients' care. So that's really where peer review comes in, is that we're going to be doing reviews of the physicians to determine that the care that they're providing is appropriate. And when it's not appropriate, or whether there's some question as to whether there might have been a better way of doing it, how we would go about advocating for that type of change and communicating that to the physicians. And then HHHC in Chapter 2 under Governance has a section that refers to peer review. And of course, there's an entire section in Chapter 2 about peer review, but this is what introduces that topic. And this is what it says. Upon receipt of the completed reappointment application, the organization will conduct a primary or secondary source verification of the items listed. And at the time of reappointment, consideration by the governing body, the entire reappointment application and peer review results and activities completed in accordance with 2B will be considered, 2.3. So in order to pass your HHHC accreditation standards and also to comply with the CMS requirements, you're going to have to do peer review. So let's ask a number of questions.
Who needs to be peer reviewed?
So this would be any credentialed providers within your organization, such as the physicians and the surgeons that are credentialed to do procedures at your organization, the anesthesiologists that are credentialed to work there, any CRNAs, any PAs, any nurse practitioners, et cetera. Anybody that's not actually an employee of the organization will have to be peer reviewed.
Okay, and one component, the random chart reviews, what is included in that?
So we should be doing random chart audits of all of the providers that you're going to peer review. And what I recommend is to keep the peer review there, the random chart review, simple. In other words, ask them a limited number of questions and focus on questions that only a doctor can answer. You know, don't ask the doctor to determine whether a signature was on a page. That's something that a nurse can do. You want the physicians to be asking or to be asked questions that only they, with their expertise as a physician, can indeed answer. So, for example, I have a series of about 6-7 questions that I like to include in all of our peer reviews, and I'll just run through them. Is the consent consistent with the operative report, the history and physical, and the diagnosis? In other words, when the consent was filled out, was that appropriate given everything else that was done in the procedure, the operative, which is documented in the operative report and the history and physical and the diagnosis? Second, are pre- and post-op orders appropriate to the patient's condition and the surgical findings? Again, another question that really only a physician can answer. Were the orders that were rendered prior to the procedure appropriate given the condition that the patient arrived in and the results of the surgical findings or the surgical findings that came out? Third, is the preoperative diagnosis consistent with the history and physical? In other words, does the information, is the reason that this person came to the procedure agree with the history and physical? Does the patient actually present with the problem that he was scheduled or he or she was scheduled to have the procedure for? Fourth is, was a surgical procedure consistent with the preoperative diagnosis? Again, only a physician can answer this question. Did we actually perform a procedure that was necessary based upon what the patient arrived with from a diagnosis standpoint? Fifth is, does the operative report adequately describe the details of the procedure? Again, only a question that a physician can answer here is, did they actually perform what would normally be expected to be performed given the details of the procedure, what was expected to be done? Next is, are follow-up care and or discharge instructions adequate and appropriate? Again, another question that only a physician can answer. Did they prescribe a aftercare that is consistent with what was performed and the needs of the patient after the procedure? And lastly is, when significant or sustained deviations from normal values or expectations were observed, were interventions timely and appropriate? And this is a question that would only really be answered if something happened during the procedure, either minor or major. And this question would be particularly important for the next area we're going to talk about, which are focused reviews. These are great questions to ask a physician when they're evaluating peer review. This gives them an opportunity to kind of really evaluate that chart based upon things that only a physician can answer for us.
You mentioned focused reviews. Now, when would you do those and what would be included?
So a focused review is a review that's done based upon some type of a complication that occurred, patient transfer, any type of an event that falls outside the norm. Now, you're not necessarily going to do this for every complication. For example, in an ophthalmology procedure, if you have a unplanned vitrectomy, I don't think we need to do a focused review every single time that you have unplanned vitrectomy. But if a physician has an unusually high number of unplanned vitrectomies, then you might decide to do a focus review. So a focus review means that a peer reviewed the chart for a patient that had some type of a complication. Let's say a patient was transferred to the hospital after a GI procedure that seemed to have some type of a post-op bleed. In that case, we would have a peer review that chart to determine that the procedure was performed properly, that the physician did everything proper, the post-operative care that was provided, whatever happened in the hospital afterwards in order to provide ongoing care is appropriate based upon the complication that occurred. And the whole goal here is to kind of evaluate that physician's care to determine whether there was anything that could have been done to prevent that patient from being transferred to the hospital. Now, often these focus reviews just come back and say this is a normal complication and that everything was handled appropriately. But again, you know, anytime that you have multiple complications for a given provider, these focus reviews become quite important. And focus reviews are something that surveyors are looking for virtually for every, you know, major complication that occurs after a procedure.
Okay. And when you say peer, you mean somebody who has the same level of training, that specializes in the same area as the person they're reviewing?
Yes. And actually, this is one of the problems that we are finding is that sometimes these peers, you know, let's face it, physicians don't always, first of all, they don't really want to do peer reviews. This is not one of the things that they enjoy doing at all. And they're put on the spot because they're being asked to peer review a friend sometimes or, you know, another colleague. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, the peer review is being done on each other. So you review my charts, I review yours. And there's just a tendency to kind of just gloss over these things. So we have to make sure it happens in some organizations that one poor doctor ends up being the guy that has to do the peer reviews for everybody else. Mm-hmm. Where this becomes a problem is when that peer is really not a peer. You don't want to have somebody an orthopod reviewing the charts for a GI doctor, for example, or vice versa. So you want to make sure that when we're looking at a peer, that truly they have very similar training. You know, you're also reviewing people that are at the same level. You don't want to have a PA reviewing a physician you don't want to have somebody reviewing somebody that is of a higher level of education and training. Mm-hmm. So you really do have to look for peers. And sometimes this is going to mean that you're going to have to go outside the organization. So, you know, ask friends that you've worked with, physicians in other areas. And, you know, often you can find a way to reciprocate by, you know, looking at their charts. In our organization, you know, as a consultant, sometimes we're able to match up physicians in one of our organizations with physicians in another organization and find that it's a very good way of, you know, getting some solid peer reviews done.
You know, how do you do an annual summary of providers and what else would be included in the peer review?
So what do you do after you gather all this information? and again, this is another one of those areas that people tend to kind of not really follow through appropriately. Mm-hmm. So they'll do the peer reviews, they'll produce them, maybe they'll even report them to the governing body. But then you don't have a demonstrated attachment to the recredentialing of the providers. So what we want to see here is, and HHHC is requiring this now, and some of the other organizations will probably follow eventually, but they're requiring an annual review. So no longer are we in a position with at least HHHC where you can allow physicians to do peer reviews every 2 years upon recredentialing, every 3 years. So you need to do this consistently. You need to be able to report out annually, produce some type of an annual report. We call it a report card. That's not always a great term for physicians, but some type of an annual summary of the care that was provided. And in this annual report, you're going to provide not only the results of the peer reviews and the focused reviews, not only the random chart reviews and the focused reviews, but also additional factors that might come into play in this peer review that would have a bearing on the decision as to, you know, whether to recredential this person upon recredentialing. So the other types of things you would include is total volume, number of cases that were performed, for example, because that's an important factor. You know, if you're only doing a couple, you're not going to get a lot of good peer review out of that. Mm-hmm. But if you're doing 1,000 of the procedures, you have a lot of an opportunity to get a very good cross-section of it. You're going to also want to identify if there were any grievances or complaints against the physician during that year. Issues with staff. So this would be, you know, if the staff continues to indicate that they're having issues with working with this particular physician and, finding that they're not easy to work with or that there might be, some ongoing, challenges in working with that doctor. The timeliness of chart completion. So this is how you kind of enforce on the doctors that they need to get those charts done on time. Mm-hmm. The number of incidents, you know, in addition to actual review of the cases through the focused reviews, but the number of incidents that the doctors would have in each of these areas. And this is where you're going to be looking at, you know, number of perforations, for example, with GI doctors or the number of unplanned vitrectomies with eye doctors. And then specialty-specific incidents, too, as I mentioned actually just right now, you know, the perforations and the unplanned vitrectomies. And then compliance with facility policies and procedures. How is this physician with following the rules and regulations, the policies and procedures of the organization? Okay, that's a pretty good summary of how peer review works in an organization and the types of things you might be able to do in order to enhance your peer review program. Let's take a short break, and we'll come back and talk about another topic. Let's talk about what's coming up in the ASC podcast with John Gailey. Each week, we discuss the latest news in the industry, discuss upcoming events, and review one or two areas of interest to ASC professionals. As we noted earlier in the podcast, next week, June 4th, 2018, next we'll be reviewing pharmaceutical services, opioid use, and how to decrease it, and an anesthesiologist's perspective on appropriate candidates for surgery. And we're going to have two guests, both anesthesiologists, joining us. June 11th, 2018, we'll be discussing Medicare quality reporting with our guest, Gina Thronberry from the ASC Association. June 18th, we'll finally start straying away from regulatory compliance for a week and discuss information technology, EMR, and cybersecurity with our guest, Nelson Gomes. June 25th, 2018, we'll be discussing safety, both patient and employee, talking a little bit about OSHA and other issues surrounding patient and employee safety. And our guest speaker will be Betsy McCoy. And on July 2nd, we'll have another extended podcast discussing employee orientation, education, and in-services. All podcast content, of course, is subject to change if something important comes up that we should have to address.
So let's talk about some upcoming events in the ASC industry. Every week, we will inform you of upcoming events. If you would like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com.
Note that we have also a calendar of events on our website at www.ascpodcast.com. And Sue, I finally got it to work. I know we've been having a lot of problems with it. So all of the content is up there right now. Hopefully it'll continue to work.
The New Jersey Association of ASCs has their 8th Annual Ambulatory Surgery Conference on June 12th and 13th at the Wilshire Grand Hotel.
Becker's 16th Annual Future of Spine and the Spine Orthopedic and Pain Management Driven ASC Conference is June 14th through the 16th at the Swiss Hotel in Chicago, Illinois.
Registration for the online CAPE exam that will be administered during the month of October at various testing sites throughout the United States is August 1st through 31st, 2018. To register, go to www.aboutcape.org. That's www.aboutcape.org.
California Ambulatory Surgery Association has its CASA annual conference September 5th through the 7th, 2018 in Huntington Beach.
The Ohio State Association meeting will be September 18th through the 20th at the Hilton Polaris in Columbus, Ohio.
The 5th annual New York Metro ASC Symposium will be November 2nd, 2018 at the Marriott Marquis in the heart of Times Square.
CASA Infection Prevention Seminar will be November 7th and 8th, 2018 in Costa Mesa.
Registration for the online CASC exam that will be administered during the month of August at various testing locations throughout the United States is May 1st through the 31st, so get on it right away since I think this episode drops on 5/28, so you better do it pretty quickly. To do this, register at www.aboutcasc.org. That's www.aboutcasc.org. Thankfully, for those of you who probably won't be able to register before the end of May here, another testing period is in October 2018, and the registration for that exam will be August 1st through the 31st.
If you would like your event listed on our website and discussed on air, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com.
Well, that's it for this week's podcast, and please spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button. See you all next week.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, all rights reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you are interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.